going to start with a short recitation to pay homage to the Buddha, his teaching, and the practicing community. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Last week, we focused on managing negative emotion by using compassion. Today, I'd like to speak on the same line, on the importance of positive emotion. In today's world, we like to claim that we are very much independent financially, independent in terms of thinking, in decision making, in the type of profession we like to pursue. You know, we like to claim that, you know, we are very much independent. Independent means, you know, you are free, you are not being forced by anyone to do anything that you don't like. But here today, I'd like to say that unless you are emotionally free, emotionally independent, you are not independent. And you don't have your destiny in your hands, not yet. Today, I'd like to speak and also, you know, to lead you in guided meditation, short session, focusing on joyful feeling, the importance of joyful feeling. All of us sitting here in this room, we have enough condition to be joyful. But we are not joyful all the time. We are not happy. I don't want to say most of the time, you know, many times we are not happy. The condition that we have, good education, good environment, good job, good colleagues, security, you know, look at what happened in Libya, in Iraq, in that kind of place, you know, we are in a much safer place. Well, the condition that we have in our life, often they are not enough to make us happy. And in the absence of true happiness, we like to chase what we consider to be happiness. At some time, we even mistake, we are mistaken, you know, excitement for happiness. Excitement is not happiness because excitement doesn't repeat itself on the same thing. If you're excited with a very nice Italian pasta, I give you another, you know, the same pasta tomorrow. The excitement factor won't be there. Then your emotional connection with the pasta will be less. Meaning, okay, you are not, you don't feel joyful having this pasta. The reason is because the excitement factor is taken away. But we cannot keep changing all the time. We go to the same job, we live in the same place, for many years. That is why in the monastic life, we are given this test, you know, from day one. Okay, we have to wear the same uniform. And so you get up in the morning, and you know you have your eyes on many colors and many choices of clothes. We don't have this, so we have to deal with the restless mind that looks for excitement. And once you have been able to manage the restless mind, actually the same uniform doesn't really matter. It doesn't make you unhappy. It doesn't make you feel less confident. It doesn't take away your self-esteem. You know, it will happen to you if you have to wear the same clothes and go to work the same day, every day. For many people, that would be very uncomfortable because the mind inside is restless. Individually, you may be able to afford that. But can the world afford this? Can the world afford this? If somebody is rich enough to demolish, you know, the house that they feel no longer excited with, and build a new one. But the resources of the world are limited, and we have to share. So also for the ethics, for the environmental ethic, that we learn how to manage our emotion so that we don't keep changing very often, every now and then. Another thing is, this evening, the positive emotion that I'm, shall I say, promoting, the positive emotion that I'm promoting through mindfulness this evening is important in the sense if you cannot rejoice in your own success and achievement, then it's difficult to rejoice in other people's achievement. People may argue, you know, people often argue with me, especially in England. People are very reserved by nature, the British people, and they find it difficult to congratulate themselves for their success. And they're very generous and forthcoming to congratulate other people. But are you doing this out of social norm? Being part of, you know, the elite and educated and cultured people, civilized people. Are you genuinely happy when you see somebody who is doing the same thing with you, meaning who is in competition with you, being successful? Are you happy? Are you feeling secure inside you? If you're not feeling secure, what happens is that the key to your happiness and unhappiness is in the other people, in other people's hand, not in your hand. I repeat this again because this is an important point. This evening we are going to do some exercise, okay, just to relate to the good thing in our life and to develop joyful feeling. But we cannot confine this just to ourselves. If we confine this ourselves, then we can end up being full of ourselves. So we have to extend to others. extended to our family members. There are times when there comes Christmas time and then a big family coming together. It is something like Chinese New Year, the people coming together, together with in-law and everybody. Sometimes some small event can trigger negative emotional reaction among the family. I don't know if you remember or if you watched this as part of my English language development and just to see the way of thinking in the world. Keeping Up Appearances, the sitcom in England, and how people complain about the Christmas dinner because the family have to come together, and then how the environment is tense. And this is, you know, when usually people keep thinking about one or two negative emotions. They go over that again and again. Not only that they go over that, they actually use those negative experiences to form identity, who they are, that they have suffered, and they to create a psychology of victim, and forget all about the good thing in other people. When that happens, we find ourselves easily irritated by the behavior of other people. If someone easily irritates you because they don't meet your expectation, that means that person holds the key to your unhappiness. The person can make you unhappy easily. So, emotionally, you are not independent at all. You may be holding a PhD, you may be a consultant in your profession, but in terms of emotion, you are actually very much dependent on other people's behavior. If other people don't meet your expectation, you can never be happy because they hold the key to your happiness and unhappiness. In the same way, by seeing, you know, someone being happy, dressed well, dressed up well, and growing in their profession, in their social status, if we cannot appreciate their success, if we cannot share with their joy, with the joy of their life, just by seeing them being successful, we feel insecure. We feel tense. We don't want to admit that we feel jealous, but insecure feeling is there. Sometimes we say, okay, it's okay, the person, he's successful, but you know, so, I have my own life, I'm as successful, so I don't really need to care. So we adopt I don't care attitude. If we adopt I don't care attitude, meaning okay, we are losing out many good things around us. There are many things in our friends' lives, many things, you know, in our workplace that can make us happy, that can add into our happiness, that can strengthen our happiness, that can strengthen our resilience in coping with the stress and pressure of life. But if we cannot connect with the success of other people, then you have the opportunity to be happy, but you are not happy. You cannot be happy. In Singapore, like a very successful country, community, economy. You have many opportunities to be happy just by looking around. But the pressure of life is so much that we often lose the ability to connect with our fellow human being and their happiness. So what I'm trying to say is that positive emotion through the kind of exercise, mindful exercise that we are going to do is very important. But before we start the practice, I'd like to make another point. In English, we have optimism and positivism. Optimism is something which is opposed to pessimism. Pessimism is the view that focuses entirely on the dangers, on the risk, and not on the benefit, not on the potential. So this is pessimism. You know, you just observe the, you just think about the impossibility. You are being obsessed with that. But then, what about the optimism? Optimism is about ignoring the risk and almost unrealistically being hopeful. So optimism is also not is not based on reality. So what I'm trying to suggest this evening that we do is in part is called mudita. Mudita, that is, you know, the joyful feeling in one of the four Brahma Vihara, the four divine qualities. This one is not about ignoring the problem, the troubles, the pain, the irritation, the disappointment that we have. Instead of ignoring them, actually, in the last week we talked about how to confront them, how to accept them, how to transform them into friends, into compassion. You know, we talk about changing our attitude. But today, I'd like to talk about the positive thing that we have in life. One theory that is quote often is the Greek theory of 80-20 theory. 80-20 theory is that, okay, but 80% in our life is fine, 20% needs some fixing. But we spend about 80% of our energy thinking about the 20% that needs improving. And we only spend 20% of our energy rejoicing the 80%, the success that we have in life. Meaning, you devalue your success emotionally, and you multiply the fear, the negative emotion, the insecurity that you have in life four times. I'm not talking about exact mathematics, you know, but I'm talking about the disproportion that we do in our emotion management. As we all know, in the latest neurology research, you know, people use meditation, vipassana meditation, samatha, so calm meditation, and metta meditation, and also compassion meditation. This, people use fMRI to image to photo the images of the brain and the changes in 1 second, you know, you can get thousands of images, and you can see the changes in the brain. I'm referring to, you know, the research projects for the last decade or so, you know, more than that, about 15 years or so, at Wisconsin University, New York University, in collaboration with Harvard, Yale, those who have mindfulness practice, including MIT. As we all know, the neurons, they control, you know, the movement in our body. But what controls the brain, according to their finding, is the emotion. So if you have positive emotion, the neurons in the brain, even the damaged one, they can rewire themselves. Yesterday, I went to see the Takashima to see some of the books that they have at the self-improvement section. Quite a few of them talk about this already, including, you know, the Buddha's Brain, the book, the Buddha's Brain, which talks directly about this subject. By Dr. Rick Hansen. But the same subject is described by a philosopher in, as you know, from Duke University, in a book called Bodhisattva's Brain. And the same subject is spoken by the editor, the former editor of the medical journal in England, who is also a journalist, I think maybe Times or Guardian, and in Siddhartha's Brain. So the people are talking about Buddhist brain, you see, Buddhist brain and Buddha's brain, and how we transform our brain for the happiness of many. The Buddha, he, in terms of material, he possessed less, but emotionally, he was many times richer than many other people. And how could that happen? This is the interest that people are focusing on. So the positive emotion that we have can rewire our brain, and that we call, I briefly referred to this last week, as the neuroplasticity theory. So in this, I like to say that the Buddha was a very positive person. He looked at suffering. He looked at suffering. You know, the whole teaching is looking at suffering, but in a very positive way. That this suffering is something that we can manage, that we can do so that it doesn't affect us. It's possible to do this. If you see somebody is suffering with irritation and taking out on you, the Buddha said it's possible to manage this situation so that you are not affected. If somebody is jealous of you at work, that negative emotion in the other person is dukkha, is suffering. It's possible to manage this situation in a way that doesn't involve violence. You don't have to confront the person with violence. Instead, you can connect with the person with compassion. And you can also, stand on your own, success, on your own individual positive emotion, free from the effect of the irritated person. We have to ask ourselves when we read newspaper full of negative headlines, then ask yourself, check your emotional status. After you have watched an evening news or maybe news items, full of problems, you know, from all over the world, people don't usually talk about positive things, then whether you are emotionally affected, whether your outlook, your mood become gloomy. This is an important exercise. Otherwise, you're not going to enjoy your work fully. And job satisfaction will be hard to come by. So this evening, I'd like to propose that we do this practice. First, of course, we connect with ourselves, with our physical body through breathing, mindfulness of breathing. You can and follow any technique that you have learned. But after a few minutes, after 3 or 4 minutes of settling down yourself, and after you have connected your mind with the body with the mind, now you're going to be thinking about the good thing in your life, the successes that you have had. As a doctor, you know, the successful treatment that you have given to others, the successful training that you have gone through. If you are also in academic, the successful paper that you have produced, you can relate to them, you can think about them in detail, and then try to be in touch with the positive emotion in you. There is nothing that we make up, that we make it up. There's nothing artificial. We are just trying to relate to the things that are there in our life. If we don't do this, very often we overlook them. When we overlook them, we will feel as if we haven't got anything, as if we don't have enough. Because although we have enough condition to be happy because we are not emotionally connected with them, emotionally we feel very poor. It can happen like that. That is why it's important to try to relate to the good thing in your life. Good health, good job, good environment, anything, you know, just to observe that. But when you try to relate to that, from time to time, you will find some challenges. That is the auto mind, auto reaction. Something like, yes, that's good. That one was good, but I just could have done better. You know, that kind of automatic thought coming in and taking away, or kind of, you know, sabotaging the joy the potential of joy that you have. But sometimes in thinking about your successes, your mind will go to people who are not very supportive, maybe who are a little bit negative towards you, you know. Your mind can go to them, and then that can stop you from enjoying, you know, your own success. These successes are your, these achievements are yours. At least, you know, we can even enjoy the genuine effort that we put in into doing something good. So this is for ourselves, but this is not enough. We also need to connect with our family members and try to look at their contribution, their good point, the good side, the positive side in their life. Because usually the or to thought or to thinking doesn't lead us to the positive side, just to the problematic side, the problematic aspect. So it's important that we make a conscious effort to connect with the good thing in our family members. That's the second category. The third one, our friends. Usually we think about our friends when we need them. We need companion, and maybe to go and have lunch together, dinner together, to play golf together, like this. You know, we need them. And we think about them like that. What about thinking about our friends without needing them? Because if you need them and you think about them, emotionally you are dependent on them. You are relying on them. Your emotional existence is related to them. So, to think about that good thing, that positive thing, then your colleagues, you know, just to think about the contribution of each one. I think, you know, when I had the operation, my operation Dr. Tan was there as the anesthetic. Before I went into the operation, you know, I was having a positive thought about everyone, you know, how everyone is highly trained. I have gone through a certain training myself, you know, I know how difficult is it, you know, to come up to a certain standard. And in the same way, you know, I was appreciating, you know, I was having positive thought about everyone, including the secretary, the nurses, the surgeon, and the doctors, and also, you know, Dr. Kim Kin Wing, who has arranged everything. So that is why when I came out, you know, to people, I was not fully conscious, but when I started to come around, I said something. Of course, I don't remember people recounted to me. I asked them to take me back to the operation theater. I told them I forgot to thank the doctors. And so they said, no, you are not quite well now, you can do this later. I said, so no, you cannot wait to thank the doctors. So I woke up with this grateful feeling, with gratitude. Because I went into the operation theater with this attitude, with this conscious mind of the positive things that that were there, you know, in the environment, in the treatment that I was receiving. And people can go into the operation theater with fear, with anxiety as well. We have choices, and we are responsible for the choices that we take. So I'm saying now that, okay, we have to take a conscious effort to see the good thing in ourselves, in our family members, in our surrounding. This is our friends, our colleagues. But this is not enough. We need to relate to the people who we used to argue with in the meeting, for example, who have a different opinion, who we used to argue with, who don't like us or who we don't like. The people we have a difficult emotion with, it's important to relate to them. If you don't try to relate to that good point, it's something like, okay, I don't like you. I don't like the way you do. I don't like the way you think. But please kindly keep the key to my happiness. Whatever you do, if you are not good, if you don't behave the way I like you, I won't allow myself to be happy. I entrust my happiness to you. Please keep the key to my happiness in your hand, as if we entrust the key to our happiness in their hand. This is what happened to many people. By doing that emotionally, we become very much dependent on others. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on mindfulness, there is one word that is repeated. I think around 20 times. If you don't mind me mentioning this Pali word, it's called anisitoja viharati, to live independently. This means independently to say emotionally independent. So emotionally, if you're independent of others, it doesn't matter what other people do, that it doesn't affect you, then emotionally you are independent. So we are going to be doing this in five stages, maybe six, including mindfulness of breathing. The first is mindfulness of breathing for about 3 or 4 minutes, just to settle down. And then actively start thinking about the thing that you have done and you are proud of, the good thing that you have done and contributed to the society, to the profession, to the family, and to your own improvement. Just one at a time. And then the third one is your family members, just one or two family members. The fourth one is your the third one is your friends, the fourth one is your colleagues, and the last one is the people who are on the opposite side of your life. So we are going to meditate for about 20 minutes, and after that, any question will be welcome and entertained. Slow and deep breathing after a long working day. Slow and deep breathing. Just connect with the tired body, the tense body. Don't fight or run away from this tiredness. happy to entertain them. Or comment. Yes. I'm in Buddhist studies, shall I use the word Buddhist studies, academically and also in for practice. I hold as many retreats as I give lectures in a year in the country that I have chosen for the last 20 years. About mainly four countries in Europe and maybe two or three countries in Asia. In terms of, the choice, I'd like to refer to one of my academic articles that I have written. The latest one was in August, published in Japan in the Oriental Journal. In my article, I pointed out that four traditions that I am familiar with, more or less to greater or less extent. The four Vipassana tradition, namely in Myanmar, the Mahasi, the Moko, the Pa'au, and then I have connection with two or three more, but I have chosen to these three of them. And in Thailand, Ajahn Chah, I use their main teaching as evidence, because their main teaching have been published and translated into English. I can Burmese and Thai as well. But when you look at that, I know, all those four great teachers, they are highly spiritual and very advanced in Brahma Vihara. But when it comes to the teaching, you don't have many pages in their published teaching. And in their opinion, according to the commentary, what they believe is that Brahma Vihara focuses on conventional truth. Therefore, by using Brahma Vihara as a meditation practice, meaning by using the conventional the truth, like what we do, the different stages, focusing on individuals, and that wouldn't bring you to enlightenment. This is the opinion of all the teachers. Actually, this is a common position in Theravada Buddhism. But when you actually check with early Buddhism, the early text, the sutras, and the Abhidhamma like this, Brahma Vihara is as important as Vipassana. In the Digha-Nikaya, in the first, we have three volumes. The first volume has 13 sutras. In 12 of them, they talk about mindfulness practice, and then Brahma Vihara, and then Vipassana again. You can see the Brahma Vihara throughout the session is expressed in terms of, if you don't mind me using Pali first, then I come to English. It's called Pamuccha, it's called Piti, it's called Mudita. All of them, they are about positive emotion. And they form the basis of concentration, samadhi. This according to the early text. And when we ignore the emotional development, and we go into the we try to get into concentration first, sometimes using shortcut. What happened is that, okay, people are highly concentrated during the retreat, but outside, in the work environment, at home, emotionally, they are still very vulnerable. If it comes to, if they hear something that they don't like, even if you are a meditation teacher, okay, in many of the meditation retreat that I have gone through as a student, one of them has written, you know, in front of us, just below the Buddha statue, this center teaches rising and falling and not breathing in and out. You know, you are very vulnerable. So when a student asks you, you know, can I do breathing in and out instead of rising and falling? Even with that question, you know, some meditation teachers, they are emotionally shaken, becoming very defensive, very tense. Like that. Mazi Sayadaw is not like that. Mazi Sayadaw went to Sri Lanka, and one of the very highly learned monk, Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who lived up to 103 years. And, you know, this Sri Lankan Mahathera, you know, wanted to practice meditation under Mahasi Sayadaw, and that was in Colombo. After a few days, and the Sri Lankan Venerable said, you know, I couldn't do rising and falling. And Mahasi Sayadaw said, it's okay to do breathing in and out. And the progress was the same. What I'm trying to say is that for far too long, we have ignored the emotional development, and we have the clear plan in the early Buddhist scriptures, the Brahma Vihara, and we don't use them enough. Another thing that I have written about is when we talk about Brahma Vihara, the last one, Upekkha. People, you know, just misunderstand this. People take this to mean, okay, to ignore. If somebody is Upekkha means, you know, to a kind. The word equanimity in English, you know, they take it to mean to ignore both pain and joy. It doesn't mean that. This misperception is in most written material in the Thai language, in the Burmese language, in Sinhala, Sri Lankan language. Why is that? Because as a community, you know, we have not discussed enough the Brahma Vihara. And many people, you know, when they do Brahma Vihara, they stop at metta, and not so much karuna and mudita. Now, in the West, I'm very grateful to the teachers and my colleagues in the West, and the Buddhist teachers, and also the colleagues from other faith, who talk a lot about compassion. And people ask, you know, what do you have in Theravada Buddhism, what's the role of compassion? What's the teaching? Then when I have to, when you write something, when you speak something, among the academy and practitioner combined, then you need to have, you know, evidence. It has to be evidence-based. It's very difficult to find teaching on compassion. One full lecture on compassion in Theravada Buddhism is very difficult to find. Not that we don't have, we have just so much, but we just don't focus on this. I think I'm making, you know, a small contribution by highlighting this point, Brahma Vihara. When people, um, are not in touch with their emotion, sometimes they use concentration to suppress the difficult emotion inside. Some people run away from their world, from their family, to the meditation center. They get calm and peace over there because it's a protected area. But once they come back, what happened? You know, people behave in the same way. So you can see the role of emotion, how emotions shape them. So what I understand is the Four Noble Truths is about the transformation of emotion. That's how I understand it. And in doing that, we have to have to give a bigger role to the Brahma Vihara. The kind of Brahma Vihara that I talk about is that first we have to have Satipatthana as a foundation. This is different from some of the training that I have gone through. Okay, you use metta just to calm yourself down. Once you have calmed your mind with metta, then you can leave metta, you go into vipassana. I think it should be the other way around. Without citta anupassana, there's a mindfulness of thought and emotion in the satipatthana. It's very difficult to be emotion intelligent. What Daniel Goleman and his famous book, a few of them, yesterday I found here, just like in the West, the multinational corporation, and they use this as manual in training their personnel. Emotion intelligence, psychology, they have used this. They have used both the teaching of compassion and mindfulness to a certain extent, and very successful. But I think the Buddhist communities in Asia themselves, they don't talk much about emotional intelligence. In fact, some of them think if you do meditation, if you do Dharma practice, you shouldn't think about your work. If you think about your work, then you can't meditate. That sort of thing. It's not about bringing the Dharma into daily life. So this is my take. Yeah. Yes.
Why is Dharma Vihara not the conventional wisdom when it has the opposites of Brahma Vihara, mudita, there's the opposite of jealousy, upekkha, the opposite is agitation. So they are still bonded, they are still conditioned.
Conditioned in which way?
In the sense that they are still dependent on opposite emotions to exist.
Actually, that's only at the beginning. My take is that academically and also in terms of practice. Okay, I'm trying to make this simple. If you want to, in your mind, if you are happy only when you can drive a Rolls Royce, okay, you can start with this. Start where you are. Okay, visualize your side, driving a Rolls Royce, and then try to connect with that good emotion. I don't want to use the word positive yet. That good emotion. Some people think that this is encouraging greed, but I say, there's a way to manage this. Now, visualize in your mind, and every member of your family has one Rolls Royce each, and see how you're going to react emotionally. And try to use mindfulness, satipatthana, to manage those reactions. As you go along, when those reactions overcome. Now, you can extend this to your friend. Visualize that all of your friends, each one, visualize their face, all of them are driving a Rolls Royce. How you would feel? Because somebody told me that he's a GB, he drives a sports car, he likes a fast car. He was really happy, he used the word happy. But then at a traffic light, one day, somebody else was also driving a sports car, and at the red light was just parking next to him. He felt, you know, furious because, you know, he didn't feel unique anymore with his sports car. He wanted to be the only one with sports car. You know, how that sports car boosted his ego. Then by discovering that somebody else also had the same car, you know, that took away his joy. So by extending this mudita to your friends, you have the opportunity to face your own emotion, jealousy. If you can imagine your friend driving Rolls Royce and you are still happy as you are driving it yourself, this emotion is selfless, very generous. This joy becomes from, it has transformed itself from wanting to be unique. Now it's becoming universal. And I understand the word anatta, non-self, to be this. To be this one. When I meditate and I close myself with my concentration, I ignore the pain of someone next to me. This can be, I mean, if I'm in a position to have this person, if I just use my concentration to ignore this person's pain. This can be a selfish concentration. So when the Buddha talks about anatta, which often is translated as non-self, sometimes also misunderstood. Now, what does he intend to do, you know, to give us? My understanding is that anatta is the transformation of emotion and attitude. These two things, attitude and emotion, you have to transform them at the same time. If I'm happy only, if emotionally I'm strong and I feel joyous that somebody who used to criticize me is driving Rolls Royce and I rejoice in that, only then my attitude is what we say, benevolence. The benevolence of attitude, you know, will grow in my heart, and that's metta. So actually, metta cannot grow without anatta. The teaching of anatta. Anatta, both anatta and brahmavihara, they are the way to manage suffering, dukkha. At the moment, in many of the meditation tradition, we focus so much on impermanence. We try to use the knowledge of impermanence to manage dukkha. For this one, you have to be highly successful in concentration, in maintaining your concentration. But when you come back into the daily, busy, and stressful environment, you know how difficult to maintain concentration. So what I'm trying to say is that the teaching of anatta, the teaching of the Buddha, all of them, you can talk about vipassana, you can talk about samatha, insight meditation and calmness meditation. You can also talk Brahma Vihara, which I usually call this as emotion development. All of them, they have something to do with emotion. What people usually call defilement, I call this negative emotion, destructive emotion. So when you can extend your compassion and joy to the people who used to hurt you, who you don't like, who don't like you, and then at that point you are ready to transcend culture, nation, and the social concept, and then relate to people, you know, as living beings. I like to think that that's the enlightened person. If I am practicing breathing in and out, and I feel tense when somebody talks about focusing on rising and falling, then, you know, my mindfulness and concentration are not helping me deal with the emotional trouble with me. Any more questions?
Could it be possible that there are more than, because this four Brahma Vihara are actually four words trying to describe four different kind of emotions. Could there be more emotions than just four Brahma Vihara? There could be, you know, more.
I appreciate your question. At the beginning, I think it feels like that. It feels that the four emotions covered in the Brahma Vihara, they don't cover all the emotions. But actually, the Buddha has been very clear the way he defined emotion. He grouped them. You can group them into four, like in the Brahma Vihara, Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha. You can also group into two, like in the Satipatthana. Satipatthana already group them into two. In the Pali, his expression is called Abhijja Dhammanasam. That is kind of, you know, very aggressive. Aggressive desire, greed, that's one group. Liking, like that, you know, very persistent. And the other is, you know, very persistent dislike and destructive emotion, like that. So the Buddha actually put them into two. In other words, in the word that we are familiar with, into lobha and dosa. Into those emotions. Those two emotions, they can include, they can cover all the other emotions. As we go along, we come to see the subtle common feature that they have between them. Ajahn Chah often emphasized two emotions, like and dislike. I end this line. Yes.
So I find that mudita is sometimes it is very hard to practice because there's an inherent competitiveness in ourselves that when we see others doing better, somehow that competitiveness is not okay with that situation. That's maybe it's just me, but That's my observation.
Mm.
And we tend to manifest it either by suppressing it, or it can manifest in other ways, other very subtle ways.
Usually it manifests in terms of fight and flight. Yes, this is Charles Darwin's words, his expression in his 1780 publication, these facial emotion in humans and animals. I would examine myself that, okay, how much time we invest working on this emotion. The bottom line is that we feel insecure when we compete, and we use that insecurity to motivate ourselves. What the Buddha is saying is that as a human being, that there is a better way that we can do. The way to do this is to use problem. To use problem and change our attitude. That problem is not unique but universal. That people affected by this. We can use this insecure feeling in the face of competition. I mean, Buddhist monks also face competition. Meditation teachers, preachers, scholars, they also face competition. Just like doctors, accountants, engineers, and whatnot, just everyone. Then, actually, the problem that the world faces, that human beings face, it's just endless. If we understand this problem as being endless, as being common to all, we can use this problem to motivate ourselves. Say, if you are a very successful cardiologist, for example, one cardiologist cannot deal with all the cardiological problems in Singapore. You need others. This understanding of interdependency, the understanding of the depth of the problem that we as a human being have, okay, this will help us to be more generous, to be more accommodating. It's okay for other people to grow and progress. Otherwise, we feel intimidated. We feel sometimes being outdone by others, even though that's not the case. I was very struck by one comment by one of the top multinational corporate executive, Mr. Trim. You know, Trim is a company from Germany, 150 years old. A few years ago, I was invited to give a lecture at the business school at Chulalongkorn University in Thailand, and other three people, a politician, and two businessmen. One is Thai, one is a foreigner, which is the Bikram executive, you know, from Germany. They came and commented on my talk. I was very struck by and really admire what Mr. Bikram had to say. He said that, you know, he motivated himself not by competition, but by the problem. And he said this is based on his understanding of the Four Noble Truths, because the Four Noble Truths talks about problem, dukkha, 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 four times. It's a problem-based approach, problem-based thinking. If he is going to design a wheelchair, he says, he would think about the problem that somebody like me who needs a wheelchair at this point in time would face the problem that I would face without this. So the desire to relieve my problem would be his motivation. So as a doctor, we can think about the many problems that the world faces in terms of health and use this to motivate ourselves. You can have many papers, you can have a lot of successful career without putting yourself emotionally under stress. Because now your focus is the patient, your focus is the problem. That would be Buddhist thinking. Although we are putting this in a very simple way, the Buddha put forward a very comprehensive way of gradual progress practice, the emotional side, the need to calm the mind, the ethical side, the intellectual side, comprehensive aspects. In the Noble Eightfold Path, the second one, right thought, sometimes we translate that as right thought, right thinking. In Pali, it's called Sammasankappa. When you examine the three terms used to define right thinking, they are all about emotion. Non-violent, that's emotion. And non-destructive thought, that's also emotion. Non-clinging, that's also emotion. I'd like to invite you to go on YouTube and listen to Dr. Rick Hansen about non-craving brain. That's he explained this in terms of science and neurology and also Buddhist practice, because he is a Buddhist meditation teacher as well as a neurologist.
Yes. Yes.
In relation to Mahinda, this Lin Kang Ching, if Hillary Clinton had come to you for advice 3 months ago,
That was before the election.
Yes.
Venerable,
how can I win the election with Mahinda?
I would have told Clinton and Donald Trump in the same way, that they were focusing on each other, than the people they claim to serve. That was the wrong focus. If you analyze their speeches, the policy and all those, okay, but they were inspired by negating other people, about destroying other people, somebody's image and credit. And today, okay, one of them has been elected. But I think they themselves and their people are still working out what are the problems facing the country. And you will see that emotion plays a big part in whatever they say, in whatever they choose. Emotion plays a big part in terms of like and dislike. I wouldn't have one advice unique to Clinton that Donald Trump wouldn't be able to relate to this. I wouldn't have this, because the whole point of the Buddhist teaching is to look at dukkha as universal.
Stay mindful throughout the whole day, other than at the start, and after that your mindfulness drops.
I cannot answer comprehensively, but I can give some tips, you know, from my own. Number one is not to go into to ensure, you know, that we don't go into emergency mode when the body is tired. When the body is tired, automatically the physiological system and the subconscious mind, they tend to go into emergency mode, fight and flight. By doing that, we are using up more energy than we should. And we are not healing the body, because the body is tired, it needs healing. Meaning it needs preserving the energy. And the way to do it, this is to connect with the tired body. Fight and flight is the survival instinct. This is not a survival case. So don't fight with the tired body and don't run away from, meaning don't ignore this. So just simply connect with your tired body with compassion. Simple breathing, a few breaths, maybe 4 or 5 breathing, nice breathing. That's way. A kind of pause the decline of the energy, and perhaps, you know, we reverse the trend upward in terms of the energy. And well, with that physical energy restore, now it's easier to connect with emotion. Are we becoming moody? Are we being aware of more of the negative point than the positive one? Now we can diagnose our own emotion. We can diagnose this. So I think my myself, you know, I'm involved in many international Buddhist organizations. And one of the organizations that I'm the Secretary General has about 80 universities as members from 22 countries. You know, I don't have a secretariat backing me up. You know, I do everything from basic secretary work to policy decision and all those, so coordinate with others. And I have gone through, you know, many experiences of going into emergency mode without realizing it. And then when you actually do realize that, the decline of energy is due to going into emergency mode. I think it's almost 9, maybe we can stop here. So thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.